There's joy in the house of the Lord, and there has been joy, a different type of joy experienced from people ever since the resurrection of Jesus. Ever since Jesus was victorious over sin and death, there has been a completely different type of joy. It's been changing people's lives, changing individuals' lives, changing families' lives, changing regions' lives, changing countries' lives. There is life change happening because there's victory in Jesus. We've been in the book of Acts, and we're going to continue this morning in the book of Acts, and we've been seeing that life change has been happening all throughout Acts. But I want to remind us that life change that is happening in Acts isn't just some outdated story that happened back there. Acts is intended to be an ongoing story where people would continue to live and experience the life change that is in the victory that comes through the resurrected Jesus. My hope is that that's you, that you have experienced victory in Jesus, and it is changing you, and you are finding yourself living in the gospel, being transformed by who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. It's happening among us. There's marriages that have fallen completely apart in our midst because people tried to do it their way. And then after failing their way, they decided, well, I'm going to try Jesus's way. And well, they've either put their marriage back together through the grace of Jesus, or they have been remarried and set their foundation on the ways of Jesus, and they've blended families, and God is doing a redemptive and beautiful work among us because people are choosing Jesus's way. Some people in our midst have found out the most horrible news for their family, that their spouse has a terminal illness, and well, fear and anxiety and all the questions that come with such horrible news, they've decided to lay at the feet of Jesus and live into the gospel. And rather than having a miserable last season, they've decided that in Jesus, they're going to have the best intentional season they've had yet in their life. Jesus is changing people. We have fathers in our midst who grew up completely without a father. They were a fatherless young man or young lady. And they're finding that in the gospel, they have a father who is perfect. And that father is helping them change the way and the trajectory of how they choose to be a father for the next generation. The gospel is changing people. But the gospel isn't something that you and I just like drift into its likeness. You might drift into Jesus and his grace, but we don't drift into the likeness of the gospel. We have to intentionally make choices to follow that. And Jesus knew that, which is why he gave us a laser-focused description of what that would mean for us. In one of the most powerful and provocative statements in all of human history, Jesus declares this in John chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. He says, "I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him, and you have seen him." Man, do you want to know the Father? Jesus' words are, look at me. Look at Jesus, and you get to not only know the Father, you get to be known by the Father. And so as we work our way through this ongoing story in the book of Acts, we're going to notice, or have been noticing, the fact that the people who are choosing to say Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, they have been referenced as people of the way. About a half a dozen times in the book of Acts, they get references. Oh, those are the people of the way. That means they're believers. They have seen the victory that has happened in the resurrection of Jesus, and they have said, I'm going to follow Jesus and be led by the Spirit in that direction. And they get labeled both in the scriptures and in secular resources around the scriptures at that time as people of the way. And this morning, as we jump into our Bibles to Acts chapter 19, it's page 1028 in the Bibles that are in front of you. If you're online with us, open up another tab. Get to Acts chapter 19. As we're going to see in Acts chapter 19, if you and I want to navigate this broken world in a meaningful way, we will have to be people who don't just drift through life. We intentionally choose Jesus as our way. Paul's going to show us what that looks like. In Acts chapter 19, we're going to pick up this story as Paul's been doing missionary work in and out of different regions. He now finds himself in Ephesus, which is a highly influential place economically, educationally, financially, in civil world. It's a big deal to be in Ephesus. And so Paul is there right now, and we're going to pick up the story in Acts 19, verse 21, reading this. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. Did you kind of ponder where you're at in life right now? Are you drifting through life? Are you intentionally choosing life? However it's coming at you, can I just ask you real quick to ponder what motivates you? Like, what drives you? You can often wrestle with this question by looking at the things that you're producing on the external parts of your life, but I think it's an important question to ask, what drives you? Because it also reveals something deeply internal about you. If we want to be a people of the way, then we have to be anchored in the way, or we will drift out of the way. Did you notice in this text, as Paul continues to be changed by the resurrection of Jesus and living in a way that is helping other people experience this victory they can have in the gospel of Jesus Christ, he says, I am resolved in the spirit. That's not drifting language. That's very intentional language, intentional living. He says, I am resolved in the spirit. And I just have to ask us, are we a people that are inspired with gospel resolve? Is it the gospel that makes us wake up and recognize who we are and who we're not? And how to anchor our lives. It's a gospel resolve that Paul has. And so we might be asking, like, well, what does it look like to have gospel resolve? Let me tell you what gospel resolve isn't. Gospel resolve isn't coming to the end of our day, laying our head on the pillow and saying, Lord, forgive me for all the things I've done or not done today that might have offended you. Help me to have a better tomorrow. That's a good thing to do. To pray and to reflect on our day and anticipate tomorrow. But just like a blanket quick prayer to God is not gospel resolve. Gospel resolve is, well, it's looking at where you're at and looking at where God wants you to be and journaling about that and opening up the scriptures and say, Jesus, how would you lead me to get from here to there? And then trusting the Spirit to walk in that direction. Gospel resolve looks like a group of people that have walked enough life together that they can trust each other enough to say, let's talk about some hot topics that we're facing as couples, as parents, and to gather in a group of people in a living room and to look at these hot topics and not just throw out our opinions on them, but to say, hey, would you guys be praying about these topics? Would you do some research? Would you search the scriptures? Would you talk to people who have had these experiences and then regather back together and talk about tough things like family planning and all the different perspectives that come with that? And then watching a small group community of people start lowering their defenses of the way that I would do it or you would do it and say, how would the Lord lead us in possibly even different paths on this? And experiencing people helping other people broaden their horizon, understanding more deeply other people's situations, literally aching and crying for people whose experience has been horrific, being broken for those who long to have families but can't have families. Gospel resolve is about a group of people having these intentional conversations and saying, we're going to be led by the Spirit and we're going to walk in a world filled with distractions. We're going to walk more intentionally and ask, how can we better care for people that would look like the likeness of Jesus caring for people? We're not just going to drift there. We're going to have to intentionally choose that direction to be led by the Spirit in that way. Paul says, I'm resolved in the Spirit. And that resolved in the Spirit led him to a must. Did you see that in the text? I must get to Rome. He knows the influence and impact that getting to Rome would have on the world experiencing the victory that's in Jesus because of the gospel. He says, I must get to Rome. And I don't know that you and I have a need to get to Rome, but I do believe here at Madison Park, we must. We must be a people committed to this generation. This generation must get the gospel so that the next generation can get the gospel. And it's our gospel resolve that says, what will it take? What do we need to do so that this generation can experience Jesus? And that's going to take some intentional conversations, some intentional living, some intentional investment. Paul says, I must get to Rome, and I would suggest that we must reach this generation. We move on in this passage as we work through it. It looks like that, okay, Paul has a gospel resolve. The Spirit is leading him, and that creates great disturbance. And so I don't want to dupe you in any way, shape, or form. As you put gospel resolve into your life, and as we do so as a community, it's going to create disturbances. We've been seeing that in Acts. We're going to see that yet again. Look at verses 23 through 27. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. You see the way shows up here. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from the business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned people, a great many people, saying, the gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. As we find ourselves in Ephesus, if you know some ancient history, you'll know Ephesus to house this temple of the goddess Artemis, and it would be one of the ancient seven wonders of the world. And there was an economy behind this. People didn't just tourist here to take home a little token gift to remind them of their vacation. They had spiritualized this, and people were taking home idols. Things that, well, they thought would give them safety and security and a better spiritual connection with the spiritual world around them. And as Paul is turning people from the ways of humanity into following a resurrected Jesus, it is changing the business strategy in Ephesus. It's having an economic impact because the people of the way live differently than those who don't know the way. And it's disruptive. And people aren't buying idols. And so there's questions. And there's going to be this chaos that comes on because gospel disturbance will happen and it makes people uncomfortable. It likely will make you and me uncomfortable as the Lord goes to work in our life. And I think sometimes we could look at this and go like, yeah, I don't even know of the goddess Artemis. I don't do the idol thing. I don't have any sitting on my mantle above my fireplace. But I do believe that you and I worship far more than we realize. And I would guess that if you're like me, your worship isn't always in alignment with worshiping Jesus. I think you and I have some idol problems. I think most of us, there's some idols in the world that we kind of like skull and crossbones. We know they're off limits. I think of satanic worship. Like most of us would be like, yeah, don't get involved with that. Witchcraft and heresy, like that's a bad direction to walk down because we can see how destructive it is in people's lives. I think as we think through some of our idols, we think of nationalism and we can skull and crossbone that one. We look at the scriptures and we go, no, like Jesus is for all people. The gospel is to make everybody victorious. And as we look at heaven, we see Jesus saying that this is for all people and every tribe and every nation and every tongue is going to gather with God for all of eternity. And so we're like, no to nationalism. And then all of a sudden we're like, but Christian nationalism. And we start drifting back toward idols. I think there's the reality that most of us could sit around and have a conversation and say gender ideology is an idol that the world not is just now pursuing, it's been pursuing it, and it's disruptive and harmful and hurtful. And we look at it and we go like, yeah, that's not something that we want to pursue. But there are some idols in our life that I'm going to call good idols. And they're not good at all, but I think they're considered good idols because they're more socially acceptable. Maybe because they don't disturb us or the people we live among as much, but I think they're really, really hindering us from being people of the way that allow other people to see Jesus as the way. I think about the idol of safety and security. You know what an idol is, right? An idol is an image, a person, a concept that starts to get a louder voice in your life than the voice that only God is worthy of. So when you're trying to listen to God, and all of a sudden these other voices start dictating where you go and don't go, that's an idol. And have you been there? Where safety and security start determining your steps, what you do and don't do. It's an idol. And I think it's socially acceptable among us, but it's still an idol that we have to wrestle with. I think about the idol of your spouse, the one you want to have, the one you already have. We start to idolize that person. And that desire. And that turns into idolizing our kids and our grandkids. And again, these people are good people in our lives. But when they dictate what we do and don't do, we need to recognize that oftentimes we're following other humans and giving allegiance to other humans. And we have taken Jesus and the Spirit out of the equation in our life. Jesus and the Spirit are just another voice in our life, not the voice in our life, that then helps us better handle how we engage with our spouse, with our kids, and our grandkids. The idol of work and education. We know it's an idol because it starts to become our identity. We start to find our value in it. When our value, according to the gospel, is to be only in who we are because of what Jesus has done for us. We were dead in our sins and trespasses, and now we are alive in Christ alone. Not in our degrees, not in our work. We see this idol. I think we have an idol of social justice. We've become a people that it's like, hey, just go do good things. Good things make good people, and good things and good people don't change the trajectory for people for all of eternity. Only the gospel does that. And so we're not just a people of social justice, we're a people of the way, and we will do good works out of that, but we have just become, well, comfortable with being a people that do good things. And we've kind of forgotten about the name of Jesus, who is the only one who allows us to do good things, meaningful things. And then you take your flavor, but the idol of entertainment. How you find your happy place. And God was designed you to love to do things. He absolutely did, but he also designed that to be a part of your not of your life, not the leader of your life. So as we look at this, they walk down Ephesus and they saw all of these idols pulling at their attention, and they would drift from one to the other. Whatever they had that need in their life, they would try to fill that hole in the purpose of what they were designed for with these idols. And I would suggest that you and I, when we move out of intentionally saying yes and an ongoing yes to the gospel, we start drifting into allegiance to these other idols. Maybe you have some of those in your life. Maybe you live among people who are distracted by these idols. The gospel should create a disturbance inside of us in how we live our life. It did for Paul and the people who were following the way. It said there was no little disturbance among them. It's interesting. Jesus has words for Peter, who starts to do things out of human's way rather than Jesus's way. He has words for the disciples. He has words for the crowd. He has words for Demetrius right here. And he has words for me. And he likely has words for you when you and I get distracted in our allegiance. This is what he says in Mark chapter 8, verse 33 through 37. He says, "Get behind me, Satan." That's what he says. When you and I don't say yes to Jesus as the way of living, he says, "Get behind me, Satan." And then he tells us why this is so important. He says, "For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And calling to the crowds to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" We want to be very, very careful as we drift toward our idols, because we think they're helping us flourish, but really what they're doing is they're costing us our very soul. We must see our idols, and we must turn to Jesus and repent and return back to Jesus as our saving King. We see a gospel. Resolve in Paul. We see a gospel disturbance happen because of that gospel resolve. But then we look and see that it causes a lot of confusion. Well, look at verse 28 through 34. "When they had heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!' So the city was filled with the confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hands, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours they all cried out with one voice, 'Great is Artemis of the Ephesians.'" We're currently not living in the only time in history that has went woke. A riot has broken out because people of the way have lived in the direction of the way, and it has disrupted the economy. It has disrupted status. It is disrupting people's way of finding their identity. And what do they do? In a state of heightened emotion, they just start declaring anything and everything that gives them any form of security and significance all around the world. And they just raise their fist and say, "Great is Artemis, our identity of Ephesus. We have to be careful. We have to be careful in this because it's so easy to look at other people and see their confusion without having any tenacity in the way that we assess our own confusion. Maybe you've been there, where everybody else is crazy, but you're not. What does it look like to recognize as the gospel comes in and does something, it's going to create confusion among us? Two major warnings here that we see as this riot breaks out is that when emotions get high, people start to do crazy things. Anger breaks out. If you've been wondering why you're a different level of anger than you used to be, maybe there's some gospel confusion inside of you. Did you know a recent survey revealed that 1/3 of Americans are scared of the level of anger that's inside of them? They're scared of their own anger. 1/3 of America. You know what's even scary to me about that? Is most of us lie on surveys like that. So how many of us are walking around with this internal anger that has been misplaced and confused and is pouring out on other people? We must be careful of our anger in times when emotions get high. But we also need to be aware of this, that as we live by emotion, it creates even further confusion. As we're learning through this text, we keep seeing, and they were confused. They don't even know why they're rioting. They don't even know what they're talking about. They're just confused. And so they're reaching back to what they know. As you and I walk in this world filled with idols and distractions, I would just encourage us to anchor ourselves in the gospel and to recognize that you and I oftentimes have confusion too, because we're human. And to make sure that we keep our emotions in check. We're meant to feel the feels, but above our feelings, we are to be led by Jesus and the Spirit. Did you notice in this text, Paul wanted to rush into the theater, the venue, the temple. He wanted to rush in and set everybody straight. This is how this ought to be. And did you notice? The disciples held him back. And other people who were following the way held him back. That there is a time to speak and there's a time not to speak, because emotion is just taken over and people aren't going to listen anyway. And I just had to note that in my Bible and ask this question. Do I have people in my life that will hold me accountable to when to go into a situation and when to stay out of a situation? Let me ask it of you this way. Do you have a trusted voice in your life that you've given permission to text you when you post something on social media that is more hurtful than helpful? That they could text you and say, that's not what people of the way do. Do you have somebody at your workplace that you can trust will meet you in the parking lot and say, hey, that's not how people of the way handle that situation. You might want to go back and ask for forgiveness. Paul had those people in his life, and they held him back in this moment. Here's what I think is happening here. I think people of the way are figuring out that we don't just accept the gospel to respond to the gospel. We become a people who respond with the gospel. Right? We don't just come to Jesus to save us. We start responding to life in a way that people can see that Jesus is saving them. We don't respond to the gospel, respond with the gospel. Look at how this text concludes this thought in verses 35 through 41. And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, "Men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion." And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. I've been sitting in how this concludes. Did you notice? God doesn't come in and just redeem everything. In Ephesus, it's just like, hey, people are going to continue to pursue idols. Don't worry about that. Don't spend your energy pursuing all of that. Let the law of the land take care of that stuff. And we, the people of the way, be ready to live out of the way. And that will be what allows the gospel to be continued. And if you keep reading, Ephesians becomes a place where a great amount of people are saved. And God uses the church of Ephesus to do incredible things. And so in a land filled with distractions where you and I are tempted to drift, can I just remind us this? That if we want to be a people that know the gospel and live out of the way, we have to be a people who know Jesus. Not just know of Jesus, but know Jesus in a way that we can actually discern the idols that we drift into. Know Jesus so that we can discern our idols. We also need to know Jesus in a way that we can know our enemies. That oftentimes the people that we're angry with or confused by, they're not the enemy. We need to know Jesus so that we can know our enemy. We need to know Jesus so that we can know our battles. Paul got held back out of a battle that he wanted to enter into because, well, the Spirit didn't lead to say that would be a place that would be winsome to go fight. We need to know Jesus and be led by the Spirit so we can know the battles that we do and don't fight. And then we need to know Jesus, not just know of Jesus, so that we can know the way. The way of the victorious one who is transforming people in our midst in a world filled with distractions. May we be a people of the way, committed to the gospel.